Next case for argument is Aro Belidze v. Holder. Mr. Rubman.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is David Rubman, representing petitioner Nino Aro Belidze. I'd like to start off by going back over how the immigration system works very briefly. Since 1952, we've had a preference system which allows an orderly process for bringing foreign individuals to the United States. And it's a two-step process generally. The first step is either a United States citizen or a permanent resident files a petition for a relative, or there are also employment-based petitions where an employer or in some limited circumstances an individual, him or herself, can file an application. That application, generally known as a petition, an immigrant petition, is what puts you on the waiting list. Because we have a limited number of immigrant visas that can be issued each year, the lists can sometimes get very long. In some of these categories, people are waiting 15 or 20 years until they get to the top of the waiting list. In other situations, there is no long waiting list. In petitioner's case, her mother was the beneficiary of a petition filed by her employer in the category of an alien who's an outstanding researcher. That petition was filed in 2001. It was approved in 2002. At the point that it was approved, there were visas immediately available, meaning there was no further wait. This is one of the rare situations where there's aliens are not waiting for years and years and years. This is the first preference employment category, and there are not that many applicants in that category. Once that visa petition is approved, the beneficiary of that visa petition, in this case, Nino's mother, has some choices as to how to proceed. She can apply for the green card permanent residency in the United States through a process known as adjustment of status. She can apply at the United States Embassy in her home country through a process that's known as consular processing. The key thing here, which I'd like to emphasize, is those are not mutually exclusive processes. There's no limitation as to how many times you can apply for adjustment of status. There's no limitation as to how many times you can pursue your case at the embassy. The key thing here is that the initial petition, the immigrant visa petition, remains valid forever unless revoked. Obviously, if you lose your job, you can't pursue it. Obviously, if other circumstances change, you may not be able to pursue it. You may be denied adjustment of status, and you may not be able to file another application for various procedural reasons. This case involves Nino, who is the daughter of the main beneficiary of this case. She was 17 years old when this case started. She was 18 years old when the immigrant visa petition was approved. She was 18 years old when she and her mother and her father applied for adjustment of status. 2.25 years later, her application was denied. A week or two after she had turned 21. Our contention in this case all along, which we have pursued through the federal court, through the deportation proceedings, through the BIA twice, at this court previously, is that the crucial issue in this case is, can she still be considered a child even though she was over 21 at the time her second adjustment of status application was filed in 2005?
Was she represented by counsel?
At what point, Your Honor?
Was she represented by counsel?
At what point, Your Honor?
Well, tell me when she became represented by
counsel. Okay, I will. The mother and she and her mother were not represented when they first filed their adjustment of status applications. And that's kind of how they got into this mess, because the mother worked without permission. She did not realize that she needed a separate work permit while her adjustment of status was pending.
Did the university provide any assistance?
Excuse me?
Did the university provide any assistance to them?
No. Because at that point, Your Honor, it's the first part, the immigrant petition is the university's petition. The second part, the adjustment of status, is the alien's petition. Why the university didn't handle that at that moment, I don't know. I was involved very initially. I was not asked to be involved in the adjustment of status case.
Later on, and when this trouble started, neither she nor her mother were represented.
Correct. The decision of the Board of Immigration Appeals that we're appealing at this point is one which, quite frankly, I don't understand. It doesn't make sense to me. I submit that it is just bizarre. The Child Status Protection Act was enacted in 2002, August 6th, 2002.
Is this Section 8 you're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the effective date provisions. The statute was enacted because of a big problem that had gone on in the immigration system, where the last step of these cases was taking forever.
Well, and that was a standard operating procedure when I first came on this court. It would take. We never saw anything. It was under 10 years old.
You had 10 years on the waiting list, and then you would file an application for adjustment of status, and as this case indicates, it sat there for 2 years and 4 months. And if I might say from personal experience, that was fairly standard operating procedure. And people were always scurrying around trying to get something done before their children turned 21.
And well, why don't you address Section 8?
I will. Our contention is that, well, if I may back up, the initial concern with Congress was to ameliorate the problem of
You're
children.
You're running out of time. You'll have to get to the point.
Initially, as the legislative history shows, the statute was only going to apply to cases pending on or after the date of enactment. That was expanded both in the House of Representatives and in the Senate to include petitions that had been approved before the date of enactment, but for which no final determination had been made on the beneficiary's application for an immigrant visa or adjustment of status. Our contention is that means before the effective date, no final decision had been made. The BIA here says that no, if a final decision is made 2 years later, whatever, that stops it, but that's a limitation on Section 1. We believe that the clear language of this statute, supported by the legislative history, is that as long as the case was not dead, as long as the case was not over, the CSPA applies to this case. Whether it applies to the second application that Nino filed, that's a different issue under Section 3. But the first issue that we have to deal with here is, does the CSPA apply? Our contention is that it does apply. I'll save the remainder of my time unless there are further questions.
Ms. Wellhave?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Ann Wellhave, and I represent the respondent in this matter, United States Attorney General Holder. This case I think the court needs to stay focused in this case on the fact that it has one application in front of it. There's been more than one application, but there is only one in front of this court, one application for adjustment of status. And the question in this case is purely legal, and the question is whether or not this applicant for adjustment of status can benefit from the ameliorative provisions of the C.
Well, I don't know. Why is the government defending this case? What is the abuse you're worried about?
Well, Your Honor, I think what we have here is we have an evective date of the statute.
Tell me what the abuse is that concerns you.
Well, frankly, I would say that Mr. Petitioner just said that unless your application for adjustment of status is dead and gone.
Answer my question. What is the abuse that you're worried about?
Under his interpretation, this process, the child could be 46, 56. You can file 20 adjustment applications, as Petitioner's counsel pointed out. Without some bright line application and effective date rule, this process could go on forever. She could be 21 forever. As long as he keeps filing applications and as long as there keeps being problems with the primary beneficiaries.
So what? When adjustment of status is eventually granted, if it is, then she gets her right to stay here. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think that we have in the body of immigration law, very technical statutes evolving and changing
it
at all times.
And a technical statute here being applied senselessly as far as I can see, because I can't see what governmental interest is being served by this.
Well, I think at some point...
What's the fact that the board sprang this section on them without notice by this simultaneous briefing rule?
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully...
What's the sense of that?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor Posner, I would disagree that the board sprung this on him. I would refer the court to the motion that the parties filed together for reopening with the board, and one of the very issues that the parties agreed the board should squarely address is stated whether the CSPA applies to respondent Nino Arboledas as a derivative beneficiary pursuant to its effective date provisions based on her various requests for adjustment of status, and it specifically references her two adjustment requests, one being before the enactment date, one being after. The parties agreed they would go back and ask that issue be addressed. And I would say...
Did the board ask the parties to address the bearing of Section 8?
Yes, I believe the board did, by specifically granting the motion to by reviewing the motion and asking the parties to address the issues the parties specifically asked the board to address. And the effective date is absolutely there. Now, the board simultaneously did grant reopening, but then denied on the merits. But the board very clearly in the motion, that was contemplated. And I would refer the court also to the first opinion of the board. At all times in this case, petitioner has wanted to focus on Section 3, which is the substantive provision of this act. That we don't get there. We don't start doing a calculation as to how old this alien is until we get past the gatekeeping provision of Section 8.
Your opponent says in his reply brief, counsel had no inkling of the effective date argument to be made by the government. You're saying that's false?
I'm saying I would disagree. I'm not suggesting he... I do disagree he didn't have notice, and here's why. The first opinion of the board, I would refer the court to the August 14, 2008 opinion of the board. The board notes that petitioner's argument at that point was that the sought to acquire language would cover this petitioner. And the board says, you know, square on, we do not believe the definition of sought to acquire is dispositive of this case. And therefore, while we agree the term has not been well defined, we're not going to define it.
Reference to Section 8.
The board talks about, and the parties talk about, the effective date. That section is entitled effective date. Section 8, effective date. The very first board, as I look through the opinion while it's talking about that, I do not see a square cite to Section 8, but I don't, again, I see the court clearly rejecting that we're going to get to the merits of this without getting past the effective date. So there was notice there. Then, when the case went up on appeal and placed in mediation, the parties then went back and did a lot of discussion, which I know is not going to be something that we will discuss here because it was settlement discussions. But what evolved from those settlement discussions was this motion to remand, which squarely says we need to talk about whether this act even applies. And so I don't think it's our position that this issue was contemplated and was specifically,
Where is the remand order?
The remand order, I apologize if I don't have an exact, I don't think I have an AR site, but I do know that it is cited in the reply brief of petitioner. He does give you the site. It's in the administrative record. So I do believe
you're saying it's a critical document, that it alerted them to Section 8.
Well, again, when respondent filed the opening brief in this case addressing the issues that were named in the motion, we didn't make argument about how we weren't springing this on them because we didn't foresee that. But the motion for remand specifically asked that the effective date provisions be discussed by the parties and briefed to the board, or that the board opine on that. So what we have in this case is, I mean, unfortunately, again, if there's going to be clearly this statute was enacted to ameliorate the harshness of lengthy processing delays where derivative beneficiaries were aging out. Had it not been for this particular statute change, the moment that the alien turned 21, that would have been it. Their status as a derivative would have expired, and that would have been it. Congress wanted to fix that, but it didn't want to, and it specifically had to define who that's already in the system can benefit from these changes coming forward, as it always does when it changes a law. They have to enact some kind of a bright-line test as to who can benefit that's already in the system, or we're not. It would be impossible to have any kind of orderly.
So what is the specific language in Section 8 that you're relying on?
Well, I would refer the court to the opening language where it says the amendments made by this act shall take effect on the date of enactment of this act.
Wait, and say that again.
I'm sorry. The very first sentence under effective date of Section 8, it starts out, the amendments made by this act shall take effect on the date of enactment of this act and shall apply to, here's in respondent's view the critical part, and shall apply to any alien who is a derivative beneficiary or any other beneficiary of, and I'm under subpart 1, a petition for classification under Section 204 of the INA approved before the effective date. We meet that. She clearly was that. But only if a final determination has not been made on the beneficiary's application for an immigrant visa or adjustment of status. Unfortunately, there
has
been
one. Well, that's extremely ambiguous.
Well, Your Honor, which part do you...
Final determination.
Well, I don't...
Because you could regard the fact that she filed a second adjustment of status as indicating that the issue of... The issue of her right to be here had not been finally resolved.
I understand that concern, and I think it's a valid one. But my response to that would be, there was a final determination. The first adjustment application became final
yes,
when
of
she
course,
took no.
But look, there's final and there's final. There was a final action on the first application.
Right.
But her right to remain here was not actually finally determined because she could file another adjustment of status. Right?
Again, perhaps that gets back to what I said we would recognize as possible abuse. Yes, you can keep filing adjustment applications, but the problem was in this case that at the time she filed the second one...
There's no problem. Look, because our immigration system is totally screwed up, there are loads of mistakes made.
Well, Your Honor,
people don't know how to file a proper application, and so in a rare example of mercy, they allow subsequent filings. There's no.
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, this notion that people are going to file 20 adjustment of statuses. Well, maybe that's a Well, danger. There's no evidence of that. She's certainly not guilty of this, the mother.
And Your Honor, respondent doesn't come forward.
Why the government defend a case? I don't understand it. Why don't you wait for a case where there's an abuse, right? Well, we have someone who filed 20 adjustments, if that's ever happened, filed the 20 motions for adjustment of status, and finally lucked out, right? That would make your point.
Well, Your Honor,
the Justice Department never exercises appeal jurisdiction immigration case. They defend every action, every challenged action of the Board of Immigration Appeals.
Well,
right?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you said. We don't challenge. I'm sorry.
You defend all challenged actions of the Board of. You don't make a judgment.
Well, Your Honor,
the Board of Immigration Appeals is part of the Justice Department. You never make a judgment that this is not a good case challenge because highly technical. There's no abuse.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I would note for the court that we do and have prosecutorial discretion, and that is discussed and visited in appropriate cases, and it was done here. And I believe that it wasn't exercised in this case, but it was part of the process when it was in mediation. It was very much so part of that process. But again, we have a technical statute, and without bright line rules.
You have a technical statute. You're applying it to foreigners.
And we believe we're applying it as written. That's what Congress intended. Congress intended.
Applying it as written. No one understands it. And so use it to trap people.
I would respectfully disagree. Congress wrote this law and said, okay, we're gonna make
a
prospective.
You think this person doesn't belong in the United States?
Your Honor, I absolutely did not say that, and I certainly can tell you that coming forth in a case with facts of good. Obviously, good people is difficult, but I also believe that we have to enforce the laws as written. And the bottom line here is
we have to enforce it as
the law says.
There's an ambiguity because of what we mean by do we mean really final or do we mean final in what for many people apparently is just an interim step?
Well, I think
because they're dealing with this incomprehensible statute administered by an incomprehensible bureaucracy.
Well, I think that at the time the first one was adjudicated and was not appealed, and at no time have the petitioners in this case said that application is still alive. The second one starts anew, and at that point, the petitioner was over the age.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Rubman?
Just very briefly, there was no remand order. It was a joint motion to remand. It's at pages 88 to 91 of the record. The language...
Does it refer to Section 8?
No. It talks about the effective day provisions. It does. And I take full responsibility. I did not understand the import of what I had agreed to in that motion. The government presented it to me. It was completely incomprehensible to me that somehow they were saying that the effective date provisions, that this CSPA didn't apply to this petitioner at all. There'd been a letter in the file in the first application saying the CSPA applies to you. This case had been going on since 2001. And certainly when I agreed to a motion to remand, it was to reopen the case so that it could be a full briefing. And what does the board do is they say, no, we're not going to reopen the case. You brief it so we can decide if we're going to reopen it. And then they said, no reply briefs. And so the first time I heard anything about this argument was in the government's brief. The BIA had said no reply briefs. There was nothing I could do except I had complained in my brief that I thought that process was unfair, that we should have had this case fully reopened as we had agreed. And I did feel sandbagged in all of that. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much, both counsel.